From WNYC Radio, I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway. And maybe you weren't expecting to hear me at this time of the evening, but my, my, haven't we been experiencing the unexpected over the past week? Am I right? I'm here to kick off a week of special programs on WNYC. It's an extension of our election series, which you may already have participated in, The United State of Anxiety. What is this feeling right now? Surprise? Celebration? Disgust? Fear? It's as though a rainbow of emotions all pointing to an unsatisfying election result last Tuesday. Or a surprising triumph. Even if you weren't surprised by the Donald Trump victory, you have to admit the whole Trump campaign comes from a deep dissatisfaction with government and where the country is headed. So, are you filled with hope or despair right now? Who should be worried? Who can we reassure? The president said today elections matter and noted with some sadness that more than 40% of voters just didn't show up, which is perhaps the biggest mystery of all for all of us to consider. Our phone lines are open all this hour, and we're taking your calls, whether you voted or not. 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. So, did I say something about emotions?
My concerns? Many.
I'm really hopeful that maybe this country will come together.
I fear that we'll have a civil war.
Can we begin to talk about climate change as a hoax?
I'm very concerned about the Nazification of America.
I'm really getting tired of everybody predicting the end of the world because Trump was made president.
I am very, very afraid.
We need to stop all the whining and complaining and fomenting more dissent in this country.
It terrifies me to death.
So, can you identify with any of that? I'm sure you can. You can call us at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We've had a chance to see Donald Trump on 60 Minutes with his family, who we understand have been asked for top secret clearances by the Trump campaign in the transition from a candidate to an actual president. President-elect Trump wants his family to have the clearance because they will have some role in the administration, although if you saw 60 Minutes, there was no official and explicit notion of what role they would play. But it's clear that the Trump family, the Trump identity will be all over this new administration. And the appointments that we've already had in early days here suggest some of the ways and places we will go. The Bannon appointment, the Reince Priebus appointment. We want to know what you think about all of this sort of thing. Stan in Forest Hills, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you so much. I'm worried not about that he's already been elected. I voted against him. This is the most terrible thing in the country. I'm worried about the president of China. I'm worried about Putin. And I'm most worried about the North Koreans, how they're going to react to this man. This is the problem. At any given time, they could see something they don't like. And I think it is going to be a very, very serious thing with this man as president.
So you think the Russians, the North Koreans, and the Chinese will see something in Donald Trump that would be more upsetting to them than anything that's happened, in the past two administrations?
Yes, and it's like one word, incompetency. This man has no history of running anything other than a co-op or condo or an apartment building.
Why would the Chinese care if the American president is incompetent?
Excuse me, I didn't hear you. I'm sorry.
Why would the Chinese care if the U.S. president is incompetent?
Well, they can already are starting to make moves in the South Seas of China. They're starting to make moves more towards the Atlantic. So with this type of president, they may decide they want to go further.
All right, Stan, you've got a lot to think about there. We're going to go to Christopher in Staten Island. Christopher, what do you think?
Thank you so much. Your program, very enlightening, and thank you. As a senior citizen, I fear for the Republic. And, going from position within the EPA, the Nixon administration in the early days? Are you seeing aspects of Five Corners, clean coal, whatever he wants to call it? Thank you so much.
How does this differ in your view, since you do have a long historical memory here, I suspect? Why is this different from what happened in 1980 when Ronald Reagan really changed everything in Washington, and you referred to Nixon there?
Having lived and worked at a major university in Southern California, I've seen major changes. As a friend of mine once said, we are at a major place in discussion, including the mandate that our future president holds and hopefully trusts.
All right. Thanks so much, Christopher. Bob, you're on the air, Paramus, New Jersey.
Hey, guys. Thanks for bringing this up. I think it's a great job you're doing. And what I'm happy about and excited about with the Trump presidency is we need a government that represents the people. When our founding fathers envisioned our Constitution and taking in this direction, it wasn't politicians for a lifetime. And these politicians have come on, especially in the last 50 years, for career politicians. And they stay in office forever. They say whatever they want to say, get elected. They lie, cheat, promise, and steal. And once they get in there, they don't live up to any of their promises. This is a guy who's a straight shooter. The thing that made him a horrible campaigner and a horrible candidate as far as public speaking, the words he chose, the things he said, he was speaking from the heart. This is something the U.S. was not used to hearing. They're used to hearing a president tells everything's going to be great, pie in the sky, just sold people what they wanted to hear.
Okay, Bob, I love what you're saying, but let's unpack that for a second. The Constitution did not envision lifetime politicians. That's been said a lot, and I agree with you. It's absolutely true. But there are a lot of things that Donald Trump said that are inconsistent with the Constitution during his candidacy. Do those worry you at all?
Yes, I do believe that, and I think there's lessons he's going to learn. I'm sure every politician goes in with certain expectations and ideas that he realized aren't realistic or aren't going to come to fruition. But I think he's more determined than any other candidate I've heard in a long time to getting things back on track. Listen, I was a policeman for 31 years. And I have said constantly in my job, if this place was a business, it would have gone under a long time ago. Because government needs to be run a little more business-like, a little more towards watching what our goal is and where we're supposed to be. Not just, let's just say whatever we have to do to be elected and dole out the pork where we can to our constituents so they'll think we're great and they'll just elect us next time.
Bob, can I ask you one thing about the appointments that have been announced over the weekend, and that is Rance Priebus, of course, who's a Washington insider who you say Donald Trump wants to get away from. He's going to be chief of staff. And Stephen Bannon, who's this fellow from alt-right and Breitbart, who has really espoused some pretty disturbing views about white supremacy and that sort of thing. What do you feel about these two appointments in terms of getting the country on track?
I can't say I know very much about Priebus, all right? So I don't want to speak out of school on that. I tend to restrict myself to things that I'm fairly confident about. But I expect that there's going to be changes and realignments and the people he goes with at the first time. And it's maybe, under people trying to tell him, hey, listen, this may want to try this, we may want to try that. But I think he's going to stay more on track than most of the other candidates that I've heard recently. I've been voting in these elections since 1980. I voted for Reagan, and Reagan had a really tough time his first couple of years. But he was the only man. He wanted to be one of the highest-rated presidents we've had. But it took years for people to come around to see that, hey, listen, this can work if we do this.
All right, Bob, thanks so much. I really appreciate you calling. That's one person excited, two people very, very concerned and frightened by what's possibly going to transpire now as President-elect Trump becomes president of the United States. Jeffrey Rosen is with me, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. He's also a professor of law at the George Washington University Law School. Jeffrey Rosen, welcome to the special coverage. And I've talked with you many times on The Takeaway, so it's nice to talk to you again.
It is great to talk to you.
And you can call us at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. A lot of people are very unsatisfied by this result and worried about what's going to happen now. If you're a Muslim American, if you're an African American, and if you're a woman concerned about what's now being called in the jargon of the moment, normalization of abusive talk about women, what does the Constitution say about protecting people who might feel vulnerable right now?
Well, it's a crucial question, and the Constitution says a bunch of things. It says that hate speech is protected under the First Amendment. So saying bad things about groups, demeaning them, belittling them, all the kind of stuff that would be illegal if we were in Europe, is protected speech under the First Amendment, which says that you can only ban speech if it's intended to and likely to cause imminent violence. And that's why when on the campaign trail, President-elect Trump said that maybe Second Amendment people would take stuff into their own hands, that was protected under the First Amendment because it wasn't a targeted and imminent threat against Hillary Clinton. But that's not to say that some of the things that the candidate said on the trail wouldn't raise clear constitutional issues. Deportations that are based on religious categories, to try to deport people simply because they were Muslims, would indeed raise constitutional questions that I would think a bipartisan majority of the Supreme Court would question if it were put into effect, although the president-elect has backed away from that. The attempt to repeal birthright citizenship by statute rather than a constitutional amendment would be difficult. And the attempt to open up the libel laws, for example, also would, I think, be pushed back by even a Trump court or a court with Trump justices on it. At the same time, there's a huge amount that a president-elect Trump could do on his own, exercising the sweeping unilateral powers of the presidency. President Obama and George W. Bush were criticized by their critics for expanding executive power. All of those vastly expanded powers are now at the disposal of President-elect Trump, who will be able to repeal the regulatory state and many environmental and other regulations that he has questioned on the campaign trail, withdraw from trade deals, reshape immigration, rethink the Iran deal. There's much that the president-elect can indeed do to follow through on his promises, especially with the support of Republicans in Congress. And those are things that both the Constitution and the Supreme Court are unlikely to check.
Talking with Jeffrey Rosen, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. He's also a professor of law at the George Washington University Law School. And we will use him as an authority to ask questions about who should be vulnerable and who maybe simply has to accept speech because it is protected. And this question of normalization of behavior in the Trump attitude that now is embodied in our president-elect, Donald Trump. We're taking calls at 212-433-9692. And Samantha from Maywood, New Jersey, joins us. Welcome, Samantha.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. And we're very interested in trying to explore this feeling of dissatisfaction that a lot of people have that's reflected in the protests. How is it reflected in what you're feeling right now?
Yeah, so actually I went to protest a couple nights ago in New York City, and I was at Trump Tower. I just really went because I was so angry and so upset and really dissatisfied. I woke up this morning extremely upset over hearing about Steve Bannon, someone who was charged with domestic violence and someone who's an anti-Semite, a racist, a misogynist. I'm really concerned about my friends who are gay and myself, my rights as a woman and, you know, everything. I'm terrified.
And what do you think he can do? What does he signal to you?
He signals that this hate speech is okay, that someone like him is allowed to represent the American people in the White House and to be an ear and a right-hand man for President Trump.
Thank you, Samantha. Dina in Columbus Circle, welcome to The Takeaway.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm just hoping that he doesn't get inaugurated. This is really very dangerous for American, for every single American. We've been duped. This man is a con man. He's a reality talk show host. It's all about him, his family, his wealth. Look what he's putting in his cabinet already. All these right-wing Republicans. He fooled us. He lied to us. He didn't tell the American people the truth. And these people who think that he's the be-all and end-all are going to really suffer. They're cutting their nose to spite their face by encouraging all this hate this fear in America, and I'm not worried, because I believe there's a creator of the universe, and I believe that things will ultimately turn out. But we, all of us, now have to be vigilant. We can't let this man take this country back 50 years.
All right, Dina is certainly a citizen in the United States of Anxiety, which we are titling this special series of programs on the aftermath of the election that seems so unsatisfying to so many. Dina suggested that the inauguration might not actually happen, that there might be some way of preventing it. Jeffrey Rosen, is that possible?
Not easily under the Constitution. President-elect Trump has won according to the rules of the game that the Constitution sets out. Lots of people are frustrated with the Electoral College, which allows the loser of the popular vote by up to 1.5%, according to the latest count, to win the presidency. But that's unquestionably our system, and I don't think that anyone from President Obama and Hillary Clinton to those on the other side have questioned the legitimacy of Donald Trump's election, and therefore he is likely to be inaugurated.
Technically, though, the Electoral College can do what it wants, and there's evidence that electors in the past have actually had second thoughts about going with the flow. If they were to do something, take matters into their own hands, would it be seen as a coup d'etat, or would it be a constitutional fact that we would now have to deal with, you know, on December 7th or whenever it is?
In theory, electors could be faithless, as it's called, and cast their vote for someone other than the one they were elected to choose. Some states punish faithless electors, not all do. But the truth is that there have been very few faithless electors over the course of American history, a handful. You know, there are 10 famous examples. We've not in any recent years seen anything approaching a majority that would switch the Electoral College because of faithless electors. So although it's possible in theory, I think you'd have to say in practice it's extremely unlikely to happen.
Well, you faithless electors out there, potentially faithless electors out there, you have until December 19th. To come up with a decision that might be at odds with the electoral result here. Jeffrey Rosen, thanks so much. Heather, you're in Queens, and you're now on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. My main concern is just the normalization of sexual assault. I know that Donald has only been accused, not proven, not anything, but having experienced it from the other side, having been sexually assaulted, I'm concerned about how lax it's been taken, and I just wonder what's a deal breaker as far as the leader goes. Does it take him being an outright racist, using a ton of hate speech? That it doesn't seem to be a deal breaker, and maybe it's not even him I'm concerned about. It's just the people that are taking these messages that he's put out through his rhetoric and just saying, oh, it's okay. It's fine. Oh, why would he do that?
Heather, can we explore this idea of normalization of sexual aggression in the election of Donald Trump? So you say that because Donald Trump used speech that seemed to tolerate rape and sexual assault, that his election as president means that sexual assault is okay in the United States, fundamentally differently from the way it was before last Tuesday?
Maybe not. And the whole thing is, if we look back at cases like Brock Turner, other cases that have gone on college campuses and everything, within a week, we've seen the same type of lack of response from a university with the hate crimes that have been committed on college campuses.
So you think that
in Buffalo, swastikas painted already.
Right. Okay. So you're saying so the election of Donald Trump gives license to some of these dark forces in terms of misogyny and racism and anti-Semitism.
As far as I've been concerned, those messages have been there, maybe not as strongly, maybe not as publicly accepted, but it seems like in the past week that people are really taking the ball and running with it.
Jeffrey Rosen, is that all protected speech? Even the misogynist kinds of statements that Donald Trump used that people might continue to use now that they feel as though it's tolerated?
Rape, of course, is not protected speech. Sexual assault is not protected speech. And, you know, my sympathies to the caller for the ordeal that she experienced the question of whether a president could be charged or prosecuted for assaults that allegedly took place before he was inaugurated is something that we saw during the Clinton years. And broadly, the Supreme Court has said that some suits may be brought, but suits that are likely to take up a lot of the president's time to defend have to be delayed until after the election. That was the point of the Paula Jones case. But more broadly, well, and that's an important question because there might be lawsuits filed and some of those questions may be resurrected, although the ones that took place long ago may face problems with statutes of limitations. But, you know, I know it's not cheerful news, but it is a cornerstone of the American free speech tradition. Misogyny, racism, hate speech, all of this is supposed to be protected because of the belief of First Amendment heroes like Louis Brandeis and Oliver Wendell Holmes that the marketplace of ideas has to be open to even the thought we hate, so and that the best remedy for evil counsels is good ones, and that the people ultimately have to be trusted to deliberate and to come up with public reason, and that's only possible if even terrible opinions and hateful opinions are allowed access to the public marketplace of ideas. So I'm not in any way denigrating the effect of this on our political discourse, but I would say that efforts legally to ban statements by the president or his advisors are unlikely to succeed.
And certainly we can only express empathy towards Heather, who had her own experience with sexual assault. Jeff Rosen is president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. This program and a whole series of programs on WNYC are designed to explore this moment of dissatisfaction that we are feeling in the post-election period. You can call us at 212-433-WNYC. It's the United States of Anxiety. I'm John Hockenberry. From WNYC Radio, I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway. This is the United States of Anxiety. Are you in the state of anxiety over what happened last Tuesday in this election? We are exploring the emotions of so many people who are calling us at 212-433-WNYC, people who are celebrating, people who are sick of the whining, and also people who have very, very legitimate and difficult to argue with fears about the possible consequences of Donald Trump's election as president of the United States. There have been appointments that point to some possibly disturbing trends, but again, it is too early to know. President Obama held a news conference today. Did he make us all feel better?
I think what will happen with the president-elect is there are going to be certain elements of his temperament that will not serve him well unless he recognizes them and corrects them.
So a little bit of on-the-job training is what's going to happen to Donald Trump. Does that worry you? Call us at 212-433-WNYC. And is Donald Trump's on-the-job training in the White House any different from George W. Bush's on-the-job training in the White House, Barack Obama's on-the-job training in the White House? We had a caller that referred to Ronald Reagan's on-the-job training in the White House, how long it took Ronald Reagan to connect with people in the beginning. He was viewed as very much a change agent and as somebody who had some very disturbing opinions and possibly a lack of experience being brought to the White House. Call us at 212-433-WNYC. This is an unusual experience that we're having right now. Jeff Rosen, how unusual do you think it is that we're going through a period of such dissatisfaction? There were moments like this in the past. And you can argue that this is maybe less – there's less reason to be emotional about this, but it's hard to argue with.
You know, I just came earlier tonight from a wonderful debate that the National Constitution Center and Intelligence Squared sponsored here in D.C. on the question, resolve partisan gerrymandering has destroyed the political center. And there was a superb political scientist at Princeton who gave the historical data, and he said we were really polarized after the Civil War, Reconstruction. One side thought that the other side was traitors and wanted to ban them from the union and from political discourse. He said, according to empirical models of polarization, things are worse now. So the truth is that we have been getting, I learned from this really interesting debate, which listeners should check out online, more and more polarized since the 1970s. The question of whether that was due to partisan gerrymandering or whether it's due to other factors, namely geographic self-segregation and also social media filter bubbles where each side only talks to itself and becomes more and more extreme, was the subject of the debate. At the end, the audience voted, and initially people had thought partisan gerrymandering was the culprit, but then the vote shifted, and by the end, although it was still a minority, many more thought that these other factors were responsible. So whatever the cause of it, no one denies empirically that we are more polarized, divided than we've been arguably at earlier points in American history.
Do you think social media amplifies the effect of division that's seen in the gerrymandering and even in the Electoral College result here, in that you've got a kind of rural biased Trump vote against an urban biased Hillary Clinton vote, with the popular majority going to Hillary Clinton?
It does. I mean, I'll say I was persuaded in this debate that it's really not partisan gerrymandering. Social media is a huge part of the story. When people operate in what Elie Pariser has called filter bubbles, only reading news that reinforces their own points of view with different conceptions of facts, they become, Cass Sunstein has shown, the Harvard Law School, more and more extreme. In other words, when like-minded people talk only to each other, they take more extreme versions of their pre-existing positions. And then you can't have agreement about what facts are and what truth is. And then the public reason and the deliberation that the framers like James Madison and people like Brandeis and Holmes thought was necessary for democracy becomes really, really elusive. You combine that with this geographic sorting and the fact that we just have these blue coasts and red middles, and people are not meeting those who disagree with them. And when you don't meet someone with different points of views, then you can't begin to empathize with them. It's so great that you're having on this show that those early callers who were from both sides, just hearing someone else's perspective is not going to lead you to agree with it, but may lead to less polarization. But just the total failure of both sides of America to talk to each other led to things like the fact that half the country was so surprised by this election, and also by the fact that we were becoming more extreme, more polarized, and more divided.
Linda, in Long Island, you're on the United States of Anxiety special program here on WNYC.
Oh, hi. I was actually going to start with an article that I had read, which was talked about women are suffering from Trump traumatic stress disorder. And I think that more than talking about or in addition to talking about differing views and on policy, as a single parent of teenagers, one with a disability, one of college age, and we're Jewish, and it just feels like we have been completely victimized by the results of this election. And I have family who had voted for Trump, and even it's hard for me to even put past that they would vote past our interest, that we are poised to lose our health care. We're poised to lose so many things with what has been purported here. It's frightening to me for the first time ever, and I'm not young.
All right, Linda, let's talk about the health care question. The repeal of the Affordable Care Act, Jeffrey Rosen, does that mean people would have their insurance taken away, or that benefits would be eliminated for people who already have them?
It depends what form the repeal took. The latest comments by the president-elect suggest that he's willing to retain the requirement that people with pre-existing conditions are insured, and also that people can't not get insurance because they're sick, and that maybe some modified form of the Affordable Care Act would remain. The details aren't clear, but he, combined with a congressional majority, have the power to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which would leave people uninsured, or to come up with some compromise. But there's no – it appears that health insurance is definitely going to change.
Kathy in the Bronx, you're on the air.
Hi, John. Long-time listener. Okay. I'm a woman, but I also happen to have friends and colleagues in of various, you know, races, and run from secular to liberal, moderate, religious, you know, friends and stuff like that. And I can tell you that I am afraid for all the things that people have already talked about, you know, in your program, and probably almost all of the things that, you know, are to come after my call. But one or two of the things that people have not brought up too much yet. I mean, somebody just mentioned, you know, disability, but people haven't mentioned too much people who are poor, and people who can be poor through, you know, accidents, you know, who obviously the people, they're all people who have lost and rust belt jobs. But I'm afraid of Trump going along with Ryan and the conservatives who've been planning for years to either privatize Social Security and Medicare, and also to slash Social Security disability and Medicaid. And yes, I know Obama, unfortunately, started to, you know, lower food stamp payments. These are vulnerable people, vulnerable people out there. And if you look at some of the Christian conservatives, there's a whole group of people who went through the Bible and literally made themselves a new Bible by cutting out all the references to the poor that Jesus talked about.
All right, Kathy, that's a longstanding fear, the question of how vulnerable entitlements are, and that's been an issue in elections going back to Ronald Reagan and even before. And certainly those fears are in play right now in the post-Trump election of 2016. Boubert in Dover, New Jersey, what's on your mind?
Hey, so, hi, thank you for having me on the show. I came to the U.S. About 2.5 years ago, and, you know, I'm an Indian. Finished my engineering from India and moved here on a skilled immigration visa. One of the things that Trump has constantly talked about is the fact that he will work towards reducing skilled immigration also. I know we've talked about, you know, immigration on different levels, but, you know, cutting down on skilled immigration visas will probably have an impact on people like me who moved to the U.S., who eventually want to settle here and probably naturalize as citizens. So I'm just, you know, scared that maybe in the next couple of years when I apply for maybe a green card, I probably will not be considered for one, or I might have to wait a lot longer and think about moving somewhere else.
Because you're Muslim, or because they've just reduced the number of those kinds of visas?
Well, I guess it's just a coincidence that I'm a Muslim, but I'm really talking about the fact that, you know, skilled immigration is also going to get impacted. The fact that he wants to reduce a number of people who are coming from countries like India and China and working here so that he can stimulate jobs for the local American population.
All right, Boubert, thank you so much. Jeffrey Rosen, let me ask you one question. I've been thinking about what you were saying about this debate and America's sort of siloed thought bubbles. You know, there have been many times in American history where something happens and two different groups, big groups in the United States, view it so differently that there's a huge emotional reaction. I'm thinking of the OJ verdict, where blacks saw one thing, whites saw something else. That's the way America works right now. This is a very divided, separated place, and the media doesn't necessarily help to bring people together. Is this another example of that?
I think it really is. And you're right, of course, to point out big examples of people living in different thought worlds like OJ. And what this data in the debate showed is that it's gotten a lot worse over the past 30 years. The social media explosion, think of how much has changed since OJ, which was really a cable TV news world where Fox and MSNBC were just beginning to get up and running, and white people were not talking to the African-American communities that were reacting to OJ. But now the ability to engage in what demographers have called the big sort, and through social media bubbles to self-segregate, to totally cut yourself off from the opposite perspective, is just increased by an order of magnitude. And a lot of studies are showing that people are getting most of their news from Facebook. Some studies suggest that if we're only getting news recommended by our friends tend to be like-minded, and that just reinforces the filter bubbles. There is data on the other side, some studies supported by Facebook, but, you know, done with independent scholars, say that people have a mix of friends and maybe they're getting some diversity of news. But I think no one really denies, regardless of what you think about this as a partisan matter, that we are self-segregating. We are not listening to the other side. And just look at how surprised the blue states were and how surprised the pollsters were by the results of the election. They just were not talking to the Trump voters, and as a result had no ability to anticipate what was coming.
This sense of extreme surprise is distinct from what Donald Trump said and what is likely to be the policies of his administration. But we're talking about all of it here on the United States of Anxiety, 212-433-WNYC. Kelly, you're in Emerson. Is that a bubble or is that a town?
Oh, no, it's a town.
All right, very good. What's on your mind?
Well, first of all, I want to say I'm a sustaining member for the last 2 years, and I've only called in during the elections cycle, and I do have a little bit of stage fright, so please excuse me.
Go for it. You are among friends, Kelly.
My husband and I are both in our 50s. We're white. We're suburban, upper middle class, registered Republicans. Neither one of us voted for him. I voted for Hillary. My husband, for the first time in his life, did a throwaway vote and voted for Kasich because that's who we both wanted. And he knew it was a throwaway, but he had no recourse. He felt he could not vote for Donald Trump.
What makes you afraid of Donald Trump? Is it a sense of not experienced enough?
Lack of filter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's he going to do when, you know, North Korea, is he going to say he's a nasty little boy and trigger? How long do you have? Most of it is women's issues for me and my husband.
Well, let's talk about those. I'm
over 50. I don't have children. I wasn't able to have children, so that doesn't apply to me. But I have 15, well, they're mixed. I have about 7 nieces. I have a grandniece.
And you're concerned about their reproductive rights?
Yes. A 70-year-old man with orange hair should not make decisions for women. And this, not only that, this country is based on rights, not repealing of rights. You don't repeal the right to have a gun. You don't repeal the right for abortion or birth control, or we've passed gay marriage in so many states. You don't repeal. We do not repeal. We're a country for rights, not repealing rights.
All right, Kelly, thanks so much for calling, and you did very well there. And
I didn't sound very stage frightish.
No, not at all. And a sustaining member or not, your opinion counts.
Can we impeach?
No, we can't impeach. Not yet. He's not president yet. 212-433-WNYC is how you can reach us. Diane is in New York City. Welcome to The Takeaway. What's on your mind?
Hi. Well, what's on my mind is, as a person who voted for Mr. Trump, one of the core things that I voted on is my conscience regarding the future of women. And I really don't see how Hillary Clinton was de facto anointed the savior of women. There are a couple key points where she has failed women. The 1996 welfare reform, and I know about this because I'm a social worker and I study it, 1996 welfare reform, 20 years on, has basically been, you know, the all the data is in that it's an abject failure and it's plunged women and their children further into poverty. Hillary Clinton, up until very recently, was still vocally, when she was forced to talk about it, she said that she still agreed with her husband's 1996 legislation and still considered it to be a good thing, when most women know that have been poor or near poor know that it hasn't been. The other area where I feel that she just hasn't, she doesn't have, you know, my respect in terms of women is how can we be talking about Mr. Trump somehow degrading women and rape culture and these sorts of things, but yet Hillary Clinton is the one that takes significant amounts, you know, 25 million from one Saudi prince, 10 million from another Saudi prince, when this is a place where you can be, you know, killed for being, you know, unfaithful in your marriage or for being seen with a man. I mean, this is something that is seriously not in line with what I would expect from a woman who believes she is the chosen person for women's rights. And the last one concerns black women. There were a number of black clergy produced a letter, an open letter to Hillary Clinton a week before she lost the election, and they are very alarmed about the disproportionate effect of abortions that are basically done in poor neighborhoods for economic reasons. 38% of all abortions in the United States are done on black fetuses, but blacks are only 13% of the population. So, you know, there's a real concern there, and, you know, they were calling it a grave concern about black genocide, and that if black lives matter, why don't they matter on the front end, too?
All right, so, Diane, clearly making the point that Donald Trump has no monopoly on threats to women's reproductive rights, that Hillary Clinton has her own record. Diane called us at 212-433-WNYC, and this is the United States of Anxiety. I'm John Hockenberry. Stay with us.
The left is infuriated that anybody would challenge the legitimacy of their moral superiority. And so the left goes hysterical.
I think the fears, you know, while they may be there, some fabricated, some not, are totally unfounded.
A lot of these protesters are not there peacefully. They're there for nefarious reasons. They're booing us, they're spitting on us.
First of all, I hate it that people feel this way. And second of all, they should not. I think people should be rest assured.
I'm very surprised to hear that. I hate to hear that. I mean, I hate
but
to hear
But you do hear it.
I don't hear it. I saw one or two instances.
Can Donald Trump reassure the United States of Anxiety in this post-election period? This is John Hockenberry. And call us at 212-433-WNYC to register your own state of anxiety or celebration, whatever it is. Stephen Elms tweets, I'm a New Yorker living abroad in the UK. The election has left me and my neighbors in Europe very anxious. Relations are uncertain, he says. Alex Knight says, I fear cutting off access to press outlets Trump doesn't like and suppressing First Amendment rights in general. We're talking about all that and the constitutional vulnerabilities of individuals who might be concerned about what happened last Tuesday with Jeffrey Rosen, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, and we're taking your calls. Terry's in Westchester County. Terry, what's up?
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I am absolutely terrified. My question is for the person that you have, the person who's expert in constitutional law, I would like to know, in the face of the legitimization of sexism, white supremacism, violence against women, hate speech in general, and absolute idiocy as policy, I'm wondering what is the standard, what is the legal standard for when hate speech really is, I understand that hate speech is not protected, if you actually feel that it is intended to cause harm. So what's the standard? How do you prevent such incendiary hate speech, especially when we can see statistically rising incidents of sexual assault against women, rising incidents of hate speech, hate graffiti, swastikas being spray painted on Broad Street? What's the standard then? How do you stop someone from inciting to riot?
All right. Does what Trump has done already constitute any kind of incitement?
It does not. And the standard is clear. It comes from a beautiful concurring opinion by Justice Louis Brandeis. It's called Whitney versus California. I'm a law professor, so this is my homework assignment for listeners because it's the most beautiful statement of free speech in American history. And Brandeis, by an incredibly poetic passage, says, "Those who won our revolution believe the final end of the state was to make people free to develop their faculties and that in its government the deliberative forces should prevail over the arbitrary." And based on that incredible Enlightenment faith and reason, he says that speech can only be banned if it's intended to and likely to cause imminent violence. So it's not enough to just say, "I hate Jews," or "I hate women," or all these terrible things, or not in any way denying the hurtfulness and the fact that they demean people's dignity. They lessen public discourse in all the ways the caller suggested. But unless they're not only likely to cause imminent violence, but intended to do so, like "go kill this person now," and that's a credible threat that's likely to be followed through on, then the speech in America is protected. The situation is totally different in Europe, and this sets us apart, and I understand the pain of people who just think there must be some remedy against this kind of speech. But for better or for worse, and I would say for better, the American First Amendment tradition says the best remedy for evil counsels is good ones. If you think the speech is terrible, protest, denounce it, respond to it, explain why it's bad, and trust that ultimately in the public sphere, reason will prevail.
Does Terry's, who was just calling there, fear, and you could hear it in her voice, have any standing whatsoever, or does she have to just buck up?
You know, I think buck up is the American constitutional word, the emotional injury, which undoubtedly this speech causes, no question about it. And her fear is real, and I empathize with it as well. Is not something that American law takes notice of. It's in Europe, it's totally different. If that sort of stuff were said in Europe, hate speech is illegal, Holocaust denial is illegal, and there's a sweeping right to be forgotten on the internet so that anyone who believes that their dignity has been demeaned by a tweet or by someone's speech can petition Google and Yahoo and other search engines to remove it. And Google has to do that. And if they guess wrong, they're liable for up to 2% of their annual income, which was $60 billion last year. So all of this speech could be removed in Europe. Google has removed 40% of the takedown requests it's received. But we just have a different tradition.
Perhaps the framers suggested that voters would be the accountable mechanism for dealing with statements of this kind that make people so alarmed, as Terry was there. But if 43% of the electorate doesn't show up to vote, you get the results that we saw last Tuesday. And of course, you know, who knows? If everyone had voted, maybe it would have turned out the same way. Call us at 212-433-WNYC. It's the United States of Anxiety. Stephen Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm actually very concerned, I mean, among other things, but in a legal sense, about Donald Trump's financial entanglements. Now, he never released his taxes. We don't know anything about the financial entanglements of his companies. And so we have no way of knowing what the conflicts of interest will be that he's facing, whether or not he's making any decisions with foreign governments that will benefit him. We do know that he made decisions during the campaign that benefited him personally, that he says he's going to give control of his company to his children, who are going to have a part in his administration. Now, I know that, I guess, IRS records are private, but, you know, isn't there some sort of a public interest, could be argued, in releasing those records? Because there are, I mean, I know there's a clause in the Constitution, I think it's called the Emoluments Clause, I may be saying that wrong, in terms of, you know, receiving gifts from foreign governments. How can that be enforced if he hasn't released them now? I really don't believe that there's anything that will compel him to release them in the future.
Jeff, is there anything legally that can be done about that Steve is talking about? And then I want to get to some more calls.
The Emoluments Clause, wonderful to mention, says that no person holding any office of profit or trust under the United States shall accept any present emolument office of any kind from any king, prince, or foreign state. So if the allegation is that Donald Trump was secretly accepting gifts from foreign governments, someone could object. Now, Steve points to a really important point, though, because in America, law enforcement is under the president, and he controls the attorney general. He broadly decides the path of federal, although not state, prosecutions. The FBI director has some independence, but is ultimately, as we just saw with the election, but is ultimately controlled by the attorney general. So all of the questions that Steve raises are legitimate. But in practice, it may be hard to bring these suits against an administration which controls the machinery of law enforcement.
Legally, is a gift viewed the same way as, say, a loan made to someone like Donald Trump in the course of his business dealings?
Present emolument, office, or title. You know, I think we're going to have to go to the interactive constitution of the National Constitution Center, which is this incredible new online resource that I can't wait for listeners to check out. Download Interactive Constitution in the App Store or constitutioncenter.org. Click on the Emoluments Clause. I'm not going to do it for you right now, but we'll find out. Emolument may well include enticements like loans as well as presents and gifts. But on this tool, you'll find the leading liberal and conservative scholars in America writing about every clause of the Constitution, describing what they agree about and what they disagree about. It's an amazing tool.
A plug and an adventure for all of us to take to assuage our concerns about the impending Donald Trump presidency. Deborah, in Newark, New Jersey, you're on the air.
Thanks much. I'm calling in as a historian of American religions, and I have been watching for many, many months now, even before Donald Trump was nominated to run for president, that in the American evangelical and fundamentalist communities, how he is seen is with a very different type of anxiety. He is seen in apocalyptic terms. And now, apocalypse or end of days thinking is one of the broadest dreams in Christianity, going back to the times of Jesus. And you go to any cathedral, you'll see stained glass windows that have scenes of the apocalypse. It's always expected.
Do you believe, Deborah, that evangelicals view Donald Trump as the Antichrist?
No. This is what I'm trying to get to. What they see him as, they see him as profane, they see him as unacceptable, but they also see him as God's man for today, but in apocalyptic terms. That if you understand the book of Daniel, that they see him more in the terms of Osiris the Great or a Nebuchadnezzar to chasten America, even as those leaders chasten the people in Israel. But the broader stream see him more in terms of the book of Revelation, that he was the one placed here as the man in white to begin to execute the final hours of the end of days as laid out in the book of Revelation. And I want to say one more thing. They hold their noses. They don't like him, but they're watching this with the fascination of seeing a train wreck over centuries finally beginning to happen.
All right, Deborah, thanks so much for that. And if anybody who is an evangelical out there who believes along those lines, we'd love to hear from you at 212-433-9692. Steve in West Orange, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I have two quick points. One of them is you were speaking earlier, John, about on-the-job training for our past presidents, and you were wondering if this president's on-the-job training would be the same or different as Reagan and George W. Bush. I happen to believe that the thing that those past presidents had in common that this guy lacks is sincerity. So I think that his on-the-job training won't be the same because he's not sincere about learning how to be a good president. The second point I'd like to make is this is clearly a demagogue that we're dealing with here. And kind of going with what you and Professor Rosen have been discussing this entire hour, the speech aspect, Mr. Trump has clearly signaled his intentions throughout this campaign. And by giving Steve Bannon co-equal status with Reince Priebus in his administration, he has signaled what direction he intends to take his presidency. And Priebus is satisfaction for the establishment, but Bannon is for the so-called deplorables. And this guy, by the way, has the title chief strategist. So we have to pay attention to what that speech from Mr. Trump is saying to us. He doesn't intend to be a good president. He intends to be the best Donald Trump he knows how to be.
What do you think, Steve, that Donald Trump can do to further a Steve Bannon mission to make America a white supremacist society when demographics and everything in our political life says that that's a fringe position and can't actually happen?
Well, he gets to appoint one and possibly more Supreme Court justices and hundreds of federal judges over the next 4 years. He has control of the House and the Congress. And, of course, he has the White House, so he has the entire executive branch. I think with a combination of laws, administrative code, and even constitutional amendments, because he has the state houses in most of the United States, he can make radical change and dial back many, if not all, of the civil rights advancements of the past 65 years.
The anxiety of Steve in West Orange, thinking about the threats and vulnerabilities for African Americans in a Trump presidency. This is the United States of Anxiety. We've been speaking with Jeffrey Rosen, who's helped us to understand the constitutional realities of the vulnerabilities and emotions that we are feeling in the wake of this election. He's president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. He's also a professor of law at the George Washington University Law School. Jeffrey, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. It was a pleasure.
And the United States of Anxiety post-election call-in shows continue all this week at 8 p.m. here on WNYC. Tomorrow, Jamie Floyd will explore what women who voted for Donald Trump are doing now in the wake of his victory and what motivated them to actually vote for Donald Trump, given everything that he has said in the campaign. Wednesday night, it's Manoush Zomorodi talking about social media. Tune in tomorrow and all week to the United States of Anxiety post-election show specials each night this week at 8 p.m. on WNYC. I'm John Hockenberry, and we've been exploring this very special moment in American history. Thanks so much for listening.